Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
Voices, animal voices, the tremble of cool, the feminine of this soon, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind. Well, hello everybody out there in After Rot Line. Welcome to Wednesday 9 o'clock once again. It's the world, it spins, it's wonder, it's all that other crap that goes around in a circle as well. Tonight we have Greg Lamberson on the show. How's it going, Greg?
It's going very well. I feel very confused though. I feel in my bones like it's Tuesday, not Wednesday.
It's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, it's whatever name you want to put on. I mean, this show shows up on any time on the world.
I'm panicking that I'm missing Survivor.
Don't miss Survivor. Oh, wait. They record that stuff, don't they?
It's true.
I've heard that. Yeah. Streaming, man. That stuff's all over the place. So, I hear you're doing a werewolf movie.
This is true. I'm doing I'm in development on a project called The Frenzy Moon, which is a werewolf film I had hoped to do 3 years ago before a pandemic threw my plans off the tracks.
Oh, pandemics do that. Actually, this is the first one.
The film was not set to go, but I was hoping to do it. Had a little family health crisis, and immediately after that, we had the pandemic. Mm. And this particular film is a Cabin in the Woods movie. So it was especially unsafe to shoot 7 actors and a special effects crew and a regular crew all bunched together in a cabin. It just was not safe or practical. So I had to completely put this project out of mind. And instead, I did an action film called Guns of Eden. We shot it last summer. And I chose to shoot that because 90% of it was outdoors, where we could shoot safely. And that film will be out later this year.
Yes, it says completed on the IMDb. Go check it out.
I entered that myself.
Excellent. I've actually never played an IMDb on the in the guts side of things. It just seems weird.
Well, it's a strangely important thing for people on the periphery of the business, people who are just starting out, people who are maybe don't live in an area where there's a lot of film production. They put a lot of importance on those IMDb credits. So when you crowdfund, as I'm doing with this film and as I did on the last one, those IMDb credits are a big selling point.
Yes.
It's very important to them.
And it also hits density points so that if you're actually just searching in general stuff, it pulls up in Google looks.
Right.
So, I mean, do you play that with a lot of the inner workings of the tech stuff on this sort of thing?
Well, I'm not particularly a technical person in general.
Okay.
That's why I always have a cameraman, I always have a sound person, I always have an editor. I don't do any of that work myself. But I do get stuck. You know, I'm the principal guy behind all of the crowdfunding campaigns, and I do the IMDb work. That's about as technical as it gets, though, for me.
Ah, so you're the truck driver.
I am the driving force behind all of my films. And
by the way, I'm still going to say I love Killer Rack.
Thank you. Lynn Lowry was just in town for a film festival here in Niagara Falls.
Awesome.
And she stayed with the composer of the film and his wife.
Nice.
Co-composer. And he forced her to watch it, and she loved it. So that film is now on Tubi after Amazon unceremoniously yanked it twice. And it was unavailable, you know, online for long periods of time because of this friggin' Amazon. And I'm glad it's on Tubi now. I'm not sure. You know, Tubi offers some films different in Canada than in the U.S., so I don't know if it's available in Canada. But at least in the U.S., it is available for free on Tubi TV, and that is a film I'm very proud of.
Tubi TV is available in Canada and a whole bunch of other countries.
Yeah, I know Tubi's available there, but films have different rights internationally.
True.
So some titles vary. You know, they may be available in one country and not the other.
I think it is available on there for Canada, because I know I recommended it to somebody, a friend of mine, to watch it on Amazon when I saw it on there, and he did. Now I'm just going to double check to see if it's available on Tubi, because you know what? I am a happy person with that one. Yep, it's on there.
Great. Awesome.
By the way, if anybody's never heard of Tubi TV, it's an awesome place to watch the weirdest and craziest and some cool horror movies and TV shows.
Tubi TV is really online. It's the online equivalent of spending hours in, you know, a really great, because it's crappy, video store. It's the closest to that experience.
Yes.
And I think even more than on Amazon Prime or some of those other big streamers, you can just get lost searching for hours. You know, you go to a category and you're using the cursor, going right, click, 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 and then all of a sudden you notice that there's 200 more entries just on the line you're on before you go down to the next row.
Yes.
So you can spend a lot of time searching it there.
They need better searching tools, because I've done the exact same thing on all of them. Well, no, most of them.
And yeah, I've had nights where, you know, I'm looking for a 90-minute movie because that's all I can stay awake for. And after half an hour of searching, I just give up because now I don't have 90 minutes to watch a movie.
Yeah, I've done that too. It's rather odd experience. And then I go to a music video for an hour and it's like, okay, well, that's good. Background noise while I'm doing other crap.
I very often put things on late at night as background noise because I'm always editing, you know, a script or doing something that I hope is somewhat productive. But I like to have a movie on in the background.
Yes, that's good. Because, you know, I don't know how you do it when you're doing stuff. Do you like the noise in the background that actually gives you some, oh, hey, no, that's a distraction, but no, whatever?
I like the noise, and I like to be able to actually look and see something happening so I can really procrastinate. And, you know, if I put on a movie like, for instance, The Hunt, that maybe I wasn't dying to see, but I heard some good things on, I'll put it on and I won't really pay attention. And then suddenly I realize it's really good. And as soon as it's over, I'll watch it again. And then the next day I'll tell my wife, hey, we have to watch this. So I end up seeing a movie like 2.5 times if it's good.
Cool. That's an effective way to do it.
Get my rentals worth.
Well, yeah. Cool. So you're also an author. And I do want to go back to the whole COVID thing and the production fatalities, because I know that's really screwed a whole crap ton of different professional stuff being done. So with the Guns of Eden, that's the one that you did, the action movie. How do you work around the COVID restrictions or the COVID safety stuff?
Well, we shot that last summer, and if you can remember, like as we came out of spring and we're going into summer, everybody was saying, oh, you know, it's going to go away in the summer, or it'll at least be not as hardcore, you know, it'll be easier to work with. So as I said, 90% of the movie takes place outdoors. We would check everybody. They would have to do a test before shooting. If they were flying in from out of town, they would have to do another shoot when they got another test when they got here. We didn't have people on set administering tests. You know, when you do, say, a Lifetime TV movie that has a 2-week shoot, it costs about $50,000 to have a full team on board testing people before they can shoot. So we weren't able to do that. And it wasn't really a big concern just because, as I said, we were outdoors. Most people were vaccinated. One of the reasons that crowdfunding campaign was so successful, and it really was, we raised about $100,000, was that we were able to offer roles. And the reason I was able to offer roles is that, like in The Warriors, there are different factions of the bad guys, and I hadn't written a lot of them. So I knew that I could tailor them to certain people, regardless of what their experience, or let's face it, talent was, and it wouldn't hurt the film. That's not the case on the Frenzy Moon, but we did have a few people who were not vaccinated, and I specified in the crowdfunding campaign and said, whatever the mandates are for COVID, you have to follow those.
Mm-hmm.
After running the campaign is actually when the vaccinations came out, but they never mandated them. So if somebody wasn't vaccinated, I couldn't like penalize them. So we did have 4 or 5 people out of 70 who weren't vaccinated, and we just had to make sure their scene partners were aware of it and that we followed procedures carefully. One of the things we did is we did not have communal eating. I required everybody to have their own car, and they could then go eat their meals in their car. And I did have to have somebody to prepare the movie, the meals individually. And, you know, when we were indoors, like inside a barn where a lot of the action takes place, the crew had to wear masks.
Cool.
But the actors in the scene did not.
Yeah, well, I'm a big supporter of all of the protocols to put in for COVID protection, because not everybody is comfortable and not everybody is blasé about it. I mean, everybody has different tolerances for that sort of thing.
Well, I'm very serious about them. I mean, you know, from
I know why, yeah.
Social media, yeah. My daughter's immunocompromised, so I can't take a chance. But regardless of that,
yep.
I don't want anybody getting sick on one of my films. I take safety very seriously, and health is part of safety. Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole nother practical business side to it, which is, you know, if you have to shut down for a week. Right now it's 5 days, but back then it was 10 days. That throws everything into chaos. Yep. Some people are coming to town for a short while. Some people have taken time off from work. Some people have made promises to their family that they'll be able to go back and do their familial duties, taking care of kids and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it would just be a nightmare scenario if we had to shut down because someone got COVID.
Yeah, especially if your mains get sick with it, and it's like, okay, well, you have to shut everything down, because what else are you going to film in the meantime when you get around it?
Right.
Yeah.
So as I said, 60 people in crew, in cast, another 10 in crew, and a few people here and there that came for different days. So my wife's job basically was to keep tabs on everybody and get the proof of vaccination and, you know. It was just planned well enough that it was never really a problem. We did have one scare. One key player did develop some sniffles, and it would have been difficult, but we got a test right away and had the lab test done right away, and both came out negative, so it was not the disaster it might have been.
Yeah, there's a lot of false things could send people in different directions. I suffer from allergies that take up around this time of the period, and I learned about a very important difference. So with an allergy, you get the itchy. With COVID, cold, or any others, you don't get the itchy. So when I get the itchy, I know it's an allergic reaction. That's it. But that's, like I said, everybody different. Gotta take care of everything, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this because it's an action film and it's about an armed militia hunting for good guys, everyone in the armed militia has multiple guns, prop guns. So besides the safety checks that we did all the time, and they were non-firing replicas, I don't use blanks on my set anyways. So much easier just to add stuff digitally afterwards.
Yeah.
Every time they put those guns down, they have to be cleaned, you know, wiped down and stuff, and then given back to the person when they come back from the bathroom or whatever. And that was a big part of every day, was the safety checks. And nobody ever complained. Everyone knew we had their best interests in heart. But after the whole thing with Alec Baldwin, so many people said, you know, thank you for doing that. We're glad you took that seriously. And I was just taught that way by filmmakers I worked under who done action films. And fortunately, I was able to see what all those routines were.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want any kind of accident like that. I mean, I've never seen why you would have live ammo on a set anyways, because what are you going to use that for? Does it make it a better shot or whatever?
I don't know what the reasoning is for it. You know, my second film, which I shot way back in 1991, we had a scene where the hero fires a gun at an off-screen actress. I never had him aim it at her. But when you would do that with the dummy rounds, and, you know, we didn't have any set experts. We just did the research ourselves. The flash on the gun is so fast that the frames in the camera might miss the flash anyways. Mm-hmm. You may not even capture it. So you would tend to do the gunshots like three times and hope that one take would capture maybe four out of the five flashes. But that was the last time that I was ever, that I ever used one on one of my films. 2009 was when I did Slam City Massacre here in Buffalo, and that was the first time I did everything, you know, with toy guns and digital effects afterwards. And having done it once, I was like, there's no way I would ever go back and do it the old way again. Now, I worked on a film right before the pandemic called Assault on VA-33, which was an action film with a lot of names on it. I was an assistant director on that movie. And we used a lot of the prop guns in that that I used in Guns of Eden. But one day for the climax, they did have some prop guns on set with blanks, and they brought in the safety expert, and you know, everything was done right, but everything, when everything's done right, everything also slows to a crawl. Mm-hmm. And it caused some continuity errors in the climax of the film, because it's sudden, you know, we shot in December. So it suddenly goes from daylight to nighttime, like within real time of the film. And that's just what happens when you use dummies. You know, you have to take the time to do everything safely, and it slows everything down.
Yeah, well, like you said, safety first. I mean, it's an important part of I work in industrial stuff as well, and it's the same idea. I mean, you got a 5,000-pound forklift. If you don't know how to take care of that thing, you could easily impale somebody and kill them.
Yeah, yeah. I had a job for a time where I traveled from state to state in the U.S. doing compliance audits at factories to make sure they were following all the safety protocols. And I learned a lot then on just how many dangerous things there are in different factories if you're not paying attention.
So many possibilities for bad things to go wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in Canada and Ontario, they've mandated a whole bunch of safety stuff, and it's like it makes sense, a lot of them, when you think about the connection of between this activity to that activity. It's like, yes, if you're reaching out across a 16-foot area, if you're not strapped on, you could very easily fall down the... You get hurt.
I know there are those rare extreme cases where the regulations just seem ridiculous.
Yeah.
But to me, it's worth having, you know, those minority ridiculous ones to have everything else in place that keeps people safe.
Yeah. I mean, forklifts are a thing that I'm going to go on whenever I want to talk about safety, because I know more about that. I mean, they passed legislation here where you had to have them stored in a certain area, a certain distance away from each other, because there was a series of two or three fires where they actually exploded as the gas started collecting in one space and then caught fire.
Make sure you tap that horn however many times going forward and however many times going backwards.
Yep.
Never have the guy careening around without beeping that horn.
Yep, and don't have them running down and racing through the aisles.
At least not during work hours.
Oh, not any time, because you can't control that thing when it goes into a three-tier rack. And it's like, oh, that's a nice little bump. Guess what? That entire thing has to be replaced.
Even in Gus Fring's meth lab on Breaking Bad, the guys handled those forklifts properly.
Yes, those things can cause damage.
You don't want somebody calling OSHA on your high-tech meth lab.
This is true. But I only know the references you're making because I've never watched Breaking Bad except for the first two episodes. I just couldn't get into it myself.
Always worth another shot.
Yeah.
Always.
I will probably give it another shot. People keep telling me I gotta watch it. But you know me, I watch all kinds of weird stuff.
You know what? People can say that, but nobody can really say you have to watch something.
They can say it all they like.
I mean, they don't know that if you watch something, the right synapses are going to fire and you're going to dig it after all.
Exactly.
And maybe, when you're 100 years old and you're on your deathbed, you'll get through four of the five seasons and you'll say, oh my God, I'm going to die tonight. And I'm not going to be able to finish this show. Why didn't I listen to all those people who said I had to watch it?
Precisely. And as I like to say, this is why we have variety. If everything was exactly the same, it would be boring as shit.
And I think we're seeing that on Netflix now.
Yeah. I mean, I love how there is a variety to choose from. I mean, if you don't like what Netflix is doing, you can go find another streaming service that is going to have stuff. If you don't like that, there is still the old school way of finding DVDs and Blu-rays and whatever else. And if you don't like that, I hear VHS is making a comeback.
How are people watching VHS without VHS machines, though? That's the trick.
Exactly. I mean, nobody's making new VHS players, but apparently there was a big find of a bunch of sealed collectible, and it's like, wait, what? Really? Nah. I mean, I have a small handful of VHS tapes, which is just basically Babylon 5, all of the individual episodes. That's it. I can't watch them. They just look pretty.
I have I gave away most of my VHS tapes, but I have one stack of tapes that I recorded on Konica tapes.
Ooh.
And the typical thing where you set it on the long speed so you could fit in 6 hours mm-hmm. of super low-res imagery, MTV movies and stuff, and at some final episodes. And at some point, I'm going to have to get it transferred to DVD just so I can watch it.
My first DVD acquisition, ages and ages and ages ago, was a direct video transfer. And you can see that right in the middle of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh my gosh, old school videotapes. They don't last anymore. So, okay, I'm sorry. Back to werewolves. So, why werewolves? That's a common question.
Well, I've always loved monsters, period. You know,
excellent.
I wish I had been making monster movies for 30 years, and I've had long breaks between films, and sometimes for budgetary reasons, I've gone a different route. And the last monster movie, I mean, I guess Johnny Gruesome was a monster movie, but the last real monster movie I did was Killer Rack, which was back in 2015. First of all, monster movies are really fun because it's awesome to see the special effects guys coming up with them and sculpting them and going through that process and then figuring out the best way to shoot them and light them. And it makes everything more expensive. It slows everything down. But for me, it's just the most fun kind of movie to make.
Mm-hmm. So you're a bigger fan of real effects as opposed to mostly digital effects?
Yeah. I mean, the digital effects I like, the CGI that I like, is usually the stuff that you don't even know is CGI. I mean, any film you see these days has CGI because they're using it to get rid of logos or telephone poles or who knows what. There's a whole realm of work now that goes into films and TV shows just to hide things.
Getting rid of the wires.
Right, wire removal. We're going to do practical werewolves, but I'm sure when we get to post-production, we'll probably use CGI to make them blink, you know? Add little details like that to enhance them. Maybe there's a rip in a suit one day that we don't see. The guy I work with who's super talented can erase that.
Cool.
And, so, I mean, it has its uses, and it's certainly great for the gunfire. And, you know, we did a lot of miniatures on Guns of Eden. We did a miniature helicopter and a miniature vehicle blowing up, and they look fantastic, first perspective shots. And the helicopter in particular looks so much better than the CGI helicopters I see in most low-budget action films. When I say low-budget, I mean like in the million-dollar range, way more expensive than my films, but the type of stuff that still pops up on Netflix.
Right.
No, so, I mean they're all tools and they all have their purposes. But for this particular thing for werewolves, I want practical werewolves, and I think that's what most fans want too.
Oh, I mean, I'll agree with it, because every werewolf movie that I've ever watched and enjoyed, it's normally a physical effect. And I think in the same way, exactly what you're talking about, where any digital matting or whatever will be done afterwards.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to forget names of stuff a lot. Dog Soldiers is one of my favorite movies for the werewolf genre.
Well, coincidentally, today, Tuesday, not Wednesday, is the 20th anniversary of Dog Soldiers being released.
Yay, I'm going to have to watch that again. I love how they, for the whole most part of the movie, you don't see a werewolf until towards the tail end of the movie where it's like, hey, look, there they are. You only get a hand or a quick shot of something in the side corner. It's like, that's cool. It builds effective suspense.
It's a really good movie. It's one of my top five. And I have a hard time understanding those accents.
Well, I'm good with the British accent, so I'm okay with it. Oh, where did my button go? There's where it is. So what other kinds of movies do you have that you are fans of?
Well, I like all kinds of movies. I mean, I like film noir, I like fantasy, I like old 1930s screwball comedies. I mean, I have very broad film interests. I've always known that I was going to make horror and maybe science fiction. I haven't done any science fiction, but I always knew that my interests as a creator lead more towards the fantasy side of things.
Okay. And does that variety help you give a balance to what you're doing?
I think. I mean, yeah. I love Westerns, and at the beginning of the pandemic, I was hired to write the screenplay for sort of a fantasy Western. It's a time travel Western. A guy from our period goes back into the Old West, so it becomes a real Western, even though there's some science fiction trappings. I love musicals, and, you know, we had a couple of musical numbers in Killer Rack.
Yes, I remember those.
So, I think my interests are much broader than my film work, but I think I managed to make each one of my films different in some way than the one before it. I think there's a feeling, a tone that's consistent through all of them, but I think I try and do something different with each one.
Cool. And much like what we say for authors in general, writers, is that broaden your reach. Don't just read horror stories about coffins and vampires. Read zombies, read mummies, read creatures, reach all over the stuff, and then reach others outside of that, right?
Yeah, I think I even took that too far in the opposite direction, in that I read very little of my own genres these days. From time to time, I'll grab a Jeff Strand book because he's a friend of mine, but I don't read too much. I'm very sensitive of avoiding things in my specific genre, like werewolves, teenage zombies, things like that, because I want to avoid the similarities. And if they're there, I want to know that they're entirely coincidental, and there's no chance I subconsciously lifted somebody's wallet.
Right. And I get that, because I've done that as well. It's like, try and avoid, oh, I'm not going to read stuff before I start writing stuff, because I don't want that to bleed in.
You know, I know there are people who say you should read everything, and I don't think that's physically possible. Bob Weinberg, when he was alive, always said, you know, if you don't read these 10 books, you have no business calling yourself a writer. And I liked Bob. But that sort of hard line of this is what you have to read is never really washed with me.
Has he ever read the dictionary?
He may have written a dictionary for all I know. I mean, he was quite a historian in addition to a novelist. He passed away maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But he was a big figure in the HWA when I was a member.
Nice. So you say was. You're not anymore?
No. I was in HWA for about 10 years. And I think I had too big of a mouth when it came to confrontations. And I made plenty of enemies. But more to the point, I couldn't find anything useful about it to me.
Well, you know, it's good for people who are starting.
Yeah, I found a mentor through it, and it served me well probably for 7 of the 10 years. And I know the reason I finally quit was that they had a Facebook page, and I guess they had a rule that you could only do one promotional post a week. But I had a week where I sold 2 different books to a publisher's, so I announced both books, and somebody complained, and the president had to chastise me.
Gotcha.
You know, politely, he felt like a dick doing it. He said, you know, what am I going to do? This person complained. And that really was what drove me out of the group, because I was looking for, I think, a brotherhood that I just didn't find.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I totally understand exactly what you're going with. Facebook is like that for the most part. It's like if you post something that offends somebody's sensibilities, you say, oh, I didn't know that. And it's like, seriously?
Now, that being said, I mean, most of the authors that I am friends with are people that I've sat with, you know, at a table at a convention. And, you know, certently the years that I spent going to the Sephora's parties for the Toronto horror writers, always felt close to all those people. So, I just always felt like sort of an outlier within the organization itself. But when I meet someone face to face, it's a different story.
We've met face to face a couple times.
We have.
I've actually seen one of your movies in a theater with you guys.
Which theater was that?
I'm trying to remember. It was in Toronto. Because I don't usually go across the border much.
So it was probably a fan expo thing, like inside the Rogers Center or whatever the mall is.
No, it was a winter time. I remember being cold.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
There was it was this little theater somewhere, and I can't remember what the hell it was.
It may have even been Killer Rack.
It may very well have been Killer Rack.
Because I do remember about 10 of us coming up for that. We had a good time.
Yeah, no, it was Killer Rack. It was like the second time I'd seen it. I laughed even harder. Yeah, no, I'll tell you flat out. I tell everybody, you want to see a movie that's fun and weird? Watch that one.
Why? Appreciate it.
Boobs kill people.
You know, okay, we're in. Script, it was so funny. I said, I have to direct this. And when I saw that title, Killer Rack, I was like, this cannot possibly fail. And I think the title actually killed us. Because the reason Amazon dropped us both times was they said it sounded like the movies just seemed too porny. Even though there was literally 1 second of actual nudity, which we removed for them.
Yeah.
One cutaway of actual breasts. The rest of the time was the big silly monster puppets.
And yet there's so many other movies I can find on Amazon that have way more derivative information or derivative stuff than that, including full-on nudity and worse titles. And all sorts of stuff.
It's such an innocuous movie. I mean, it was always supposed to be a Zucker Brothers type comedy. Never supposed to be offensive. I think the truth is Amazon just has it out for independent horror films. They will take them. They will show them. And the way it works is, I don't know, once 100,000 people have watched it, you start making money. Some abstract figure. And I think as soon as you get close to that figure, that's when they always find a reason to yank you down.
Gotcha.
So they get free content for a certain period, and then you're out of luck. And by then, so many people have seen it for free, how many of them are going to go out and get the DVD? So it's just something that works against the filmmakers every time.
Yeah. Do you find the trend has been more to streaming rather than to DVD purchase? Because there's people like me who's always going to be around the world. I like to own copies of things in the same way that I like to own copies of books, copies of comic books, whatever all else. But I see a lot more on streaming than I do in physical media.
The business has totally gone to that model. Horror fans tend to be the ones who will still get physical media.
Yep.
But they'll watch it on streaming first. And it happens in my house all the time. I'll stream something, even though I know that if I just go upstairs and look through the shelves a little bit, I can find it on DVD.
Yeah, I found myself doing a couple times that now as well. It's like, my shelves are all over the place. The movie's stream is right there. It's easier. Click a button.
But I will say I have way more DVDs than Blu-rays. I'm not the type of person who upgrades to a Blu-ray just because it's a better format. The only time I tend to is if my DVD isn't formatted for 16:9, so it's very small in my TV. In that case, if it's a movie I love, I'll upgrade to a Blu-ray. And a lot of the ones that are being streamed are Blu-ray quality.
Right.
So that actually is a quality advantage to streaming a lot of movies.
Well, that and the fact that you don't have to have shelves and shelves and shelves, shelves and shelves and shelves full of stuff as opposed to other stuff.
Now that I've realized that, you know, you have a certain period to watch something on this streaming platform and then it disappears and then a month later it pops up on another one, it seems like nothing is really disappearing. So I don't have that urgency to get the physical media as much.
All right. I get that. And now that movies are basically, okay, movies at the theater, bam, within a month it's somewhere else on a streaming service. Like, what? I mean, Batman, the little Batman just came out like less than a month and a half ago, and it's already on HBO.
Yeah.
So it's like, I guess it's becoming more and more that trope where content is becoming the thing that drives all of the industries.
Yeah. In our house, we're watching a lot more TV shows than movies. I tend to watch the movies on my own late at night. So we're more about the new TV shows or the recent TV shows anyway.
Yeah, because I'm rewatching Kolchak, the series. I've watched the movies. You commented on the one. I absolutely, totally agreed with you. It's a beautiful movie. The TV series is awesome. They get into so much different stuff, but then you look at it and it's like, they didn't have the money back then. They didn't have the technology back then, but they still had a good story. And the story still stands.
The show had charm.
Yeah.
It didn't have the integrity of that first TV movie, that bleak 70s nihilism.
Yeah.
But it had real charm and chemistry and, you know, all those goofy people at the understaffed newspaper that Kolchak works for. You like all his interactions with them. And...
yeah. And Jamie Farr shows up every once in a while. There's the nose. It's like, wait, what? That is Jamie. I looked it up. I had to check it a couple times. It's like, it really was him. That was cool. I love watching old stuff like that and then finding somebody who's like, I like them in something else now, but then you see what they started with.
Like, I think it was sort of like The Love Boat, where you had a lot of guest stars. And I think they did the same thing with the police lieutenants, where a lot of the police lieutenants on the Night Stalker have the same name, even though they're played by different actors.
Yes.
Just like the nurses on MASH. You know, it took years before they started keeping the same actress playing Nurse Abel or you know, whoever.
Bouncing Betty. That's all I remember is one reference from MASH. It was the racing thing that they had with the cots in the back. And it's like, here comes Bouncing Betty. It's like, okay. So, back to werewolves. I like werewolves. There's not enough werewolves movies out there. But I see that there are more coming out.
So a lot of independent ones.
Yes.
You know, 1981 was the big year where we had both An American Werewolf in London and The Howling. And there hasn't been another year like that. And I think you could count on one hand the number of really good ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get into that whole CGI realm, which I don't necessarily hate. Like, I worked on a film that had CGI werewolves. It was a sci-fi TV movie called Battle Dogs with Craig Sheffer.
I may have seen that.
Wes Studi and Dennis Haysbert and Ernie Hudson. And it was weird because I remember when we were in pre-production, the producer said to me, they're going to look like an American werewolf. And he was kind of proud of this. And I was like, oh, okay, well, we're just going to blatantly rip off a look. But okay, cool. I like that one. And then we got onto set and it's like, we're just shooting plates because they're all going to be CGI. So you've got all these shots of werewolves, but they're just going to be locked down camera shots and you're going to shoot them in 30 seconds a pop. And we would race through them and not see the werewolves. And then unknown to all of us, they did have a top special effects guy on hand. The producer had paid him a little extra money to do one practical werewolf to make the director happy to surprise him on his birthday.
Yeah.
And they did this awesome werewolf that they shot in a scene with Craig Sheffer, my friend from Widow's Point. And I was so impressed by it. And then when we saw it on TV, they had replaced it with the CGI werewolf.
Oh,
so,
well, that sucks.
My friend, the producer, had actually told me, you know, sci-fi, S-Y-F-Y, will not even consider a werewolf movie without a CGI werewolf. They don't want the practical werewolf. So for about a week, I was like wrestling with this. Should I do a CGI werewolf movie on the chance it might make a sale to the sci-fi channel? And at the end of the day, it just was not what I wanted to do. So
I would never have even considered that.
Yeah, yeah. They like that cheesy CGI look. Because when you do CGI on a low budget, it usually does look cheesy. They that CGI look because it goes with the whole Sharknado, you know, mindset.
Yeah. And Underworld, right? Underworld was a lot of CG, right?
They were. I haven't seen any of those.
Oh, okay.
I haven't seen any of the Underworld movies. I've seen the photos. I mean, I get the aesthetic.
Yeah.
And my daughter watches, like, Vampire Diaries, so I know there are CGI werewolves on that.
Yep.
Legacies, but, you know, I just see episodes here and there if I'm eating dinner with her and she happens to be watching one of those things.
Have you ever seen a show called The Order?
No, I was aware of it, and yeah. I was going to watch it, and they canceled it before I started, so I said, screw it. Not going to invest the time then.
It had a good premise. I liked the idea. It was still a very CW version treatment style. This is what me and my friends call is the clean, pretty people, whatever. You don't have a lot of violence. You don't get a lot of real dirty stuff, but it's still fun.
I know what you're referring to. I have a character in the Frenzy Moon whose nickname is CW. You can figure out why.
Excellent. Okay. So six people in a cabin, much like Army of Darkness? Sorry, Evil Dead?
Somewhat, but six is more than... I think they had four, right? Or did they have five?
First Evil Dead had 5 or 6. No,
not
four.
Six.
Four. Yeah, because the car only fit four. Yeah.
It's six of them plus a stranger that they hit with their car and they have to take with them. Because it's a very foggy night, and they came up a twisty, turny road to get to that cabin. So they got to take the stranger back with them until the fog clears. Because, of course, up in that area in the mountains, there is no telephone reception.
Of course.
which is actually, it's part of the plot. It's why they were lured to that particular area. Somebody is behind them being brought out there. And, of course, there are creatures out in the woods, and either the guy that they hit and brought in is one of them or knows about them, and maybe one of them gets bitten and has to transform, and maybe one of them is one of them. You never know. That's where the John Carpenter's The Thing paranoia comes in. So there's all sorts of dynamics going on inside this cabin as the situation intensifies.
Cool. Awesome. Now, Are the werewolves? I mean, how many mythologies can you identify with werewolves? I mean, you can go with lycanthropy as being a multiple different types of things. It's like with zombies, you have multiple different kinds. How many different kinds can you really express as a werewolf?
Well, I suppose you can go in all sorts of directions. I mean, I think we typically think of them right now as either wolf men or werewolves, mm-hmm. which is the level of lichen characteristics they take on. You can have werewolves that are much more human looking, like Henry Hall, so that they can talk. Mm-hmm. You know, the old Buffy the Vampire Oz in mid transformation. And then you have the creatures that turn into either regular wolves that you would mistake for a real wolf, like in the Jack Nicholson film Wolf, or giant wolves, like in the Twilight movies. So that's in my Frenzy novels, the mythology I have is that they are wolf-like creatures who take on human form. That's their disguise. The real form that they're born in is the wolf form.
Oh, so they're weird humans.
Yes.
Gotcha.
In the books, I did all sorts of research into the way wolves used to travel in packs of 500 in the Old West, and there was a time where the government, to get rid of the wolves, was paying the American Indians, the Native Americans, a bounty to kill the wolves, and they would have to bring in the wolf head. And so there was all sorts of fascinating stuff. You know, the night the pilgrims landed, they heard the baying of hundreds of wolves on the shore. So there's a lot of cool background there that I was able to use in the books. I can't really use that stuff in this particular movie.
Right. I mean, you can only throw so much, right?
If you want a fast-paced film, yes.
Yeah. Well, you can always be a Dune. Well, even so, Dune was still pretty fast, even for a 3-hour movie.
For me, it was a chore. I didn't hate it, but I always liked the David Lynch film with all its flaws. And to me, this seemed so similar in a lot of ways and yet so inferior in a lot more ways. Mm-hmm. And I hear some people saying it was the best film of the year. I'm not going to argue if you felt that way. It didn't move me at all.
Yeah, I mean, this thing. I mean, different perspective, different takes on different products and different stuff is always going to be different. If everything was the same, everything would be boring. And then we'd probably be dead in a generation. But that's just the thing.
Which will probably happen anyway.
Well, yeah, there's probably 101 different possible permutations to what's going to do that anyway. So after werewolf movies, what are we looking at doing?
The big one for me, you know, I wrote a zombie novella called Carnage Road.
Nice.
The concept of which was the last two members of a biker gang travel across America during the zombie Holocaust. And of course, the people they encounter along the way are a lot worse than the zombies. It was just a novella, but I think it was one of my best books. Craig Sheffer had optioned this book almost immediately. We spent a few years working on it as a TV pilot, as a movie, and as so often happens, nothing really happened with it. I work on that script constantly. So, I mean, it's a big, big film, and I plan for that to be next after the werewolf film.
Nice. According to your IMDb, there were several different options, several different books or whatever, option for series and stuff.
Yeah, the Jake Hellman files are under option still by George Mihalka, who did My Bloody Valentine, another great white northerner like yourself.
Excellent.
So he's had those books for like 5 or 6 years. I don't know what's going to happen with them. He had attached some impressive talent a couple of years ago and then said, but in the first, I've got an $80 million fantasy TV series, miniseries, that I'm going to do in Hungary right now. And he went off to Hungary.
Fun.
So I'm waiting for him to finish this series, and in theory, he will come back from having been the showrunner of the show and done some direction and some writing, and will have the clout to get the Jake Hellman files off the ground. However, will there still be a Netflix by then? I don't know.
It'll probably be something else. I mean, I can't see that model or format of distribution to change. I mean, Shudder has been picking up a lot of traction as an effective horror-specific type of streaming service.
Shudder's picking up a lot of stuff. They don't quite have the budgets yet for the type of TV show that we want to do. But, it's funny. If 3 years ago, I was saying to people, what if Netflix went under and they have all this product? These movies come out, you see people posting about them for a week, and then they're gone. And if you forget them, you're never going to have any reminder to go see that film. It's just a weird kind of black hole where as it's spinning around the outside like a bathtub drain, you say, oh, I want that. And if you don't grab it right then, you may just miss it. And people kept saying, no, it's so big, it couldn't possibly fail. Now, it probably won't fail, but they're having severe trouble now. Everyone saw it coming when the Marvel shows left.
Yeah.
Then there's the people who are just upset that they keep canceling shows.
And 3 seasons now canceled. They're talking
commercials probably by the end of the year to keep the cost down. So, and meanwhile, the price keeps going up and up and up. And the only reason I still have it is that I don't own Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul on DVD or Blu-ray. So I like being able to watch that. And obviously, my wife and daughter both have stuff they like to watch. But I we're coming up on the time where I'm finally going to drop the mighty Netflix.
Do you still have regular cable?
I do.
See, I don't have any cable. I got rid of that a while ago. And that's why I like the distributed streaming services. But I'm still good with Netflix. I mean, they bring out some weird shit, and I like it.
The Hunger Games type movie, the Korean show, that was pretty good.
Oh, Squid Game? Fantastic show. I love that show. But then you're right about the, if it's not in your face, it doesn't stay in space. Because I think we're going straight to the world of Max Headroom, where it's Blipverse and everything else. And if you can't get it delivered within a few seconds, people are going like, hey, what's the next thing? And what's the next thing? What's the next thing? What's the next thing? And they keep flipping around. Because I watch a lot of stuff. And right now, if I were to try and tell you the name of a couple of different things, I can't remember their names. But I have to Google them to find them. It's like, but I really enjoyed them.
I'm watching 30 Coins on HBO right now. Spanish horror show.
Interesting.
Very good.
Is it about Judas and Silver?
That is what the reference is, and the title sequence does show Jesus and Judas suffering.
Cool.
I don't know exactly what it is. It's like 8 episodes in the first season, but I've watched a few, and each one has been almost like a 90-minute movie crushed into an hour. So I'm pretty impressed by that.
30 Coin. I'm going to have to look that up. That sounds fun. Because I like, probably much like you, I like odd. I don't like a lot of Hollywood's big budget stuff.
Yeah.
Especially not in horror. But I love a lot of foreign stuff and a lot of indie stuff. And you can enjoy something just from the pure heart that the people have put into it. I mean, I've seen a movie that has a budget of $182. I laughed my ass at it, but it wasn't the best movie in the world, but they tried. And then I've seen movies that made millions of dollars, and they sucked.
Running a film festival, I see a lot of the former. Yeah. The cheaper ones that are surprisingly good.
Yeah.
What I don't like on Netflix are a lot of the bigger budget, more mainstream movies that they produce. Mm-hmm. The action films and stuff, which I just find them really tedious.
Repetitive? Because they seem to always go for a style. This year it's going to be bam, 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 right. bam, and they're going to have 30 different versions of the same thing.
It's exactly that style. They're very well produced. Can't fault them for that. Occasionally, I guess you could say they have interesting stories, but not really, I don't think. But, I mean, they're spending a lot of money on those movies, and I think that's one of the problems they find themselves in now.
Gotcha. I can see that. But, yeah, what do you... it's a weird thing to go with, because, I mean, even Tubi's now doing content of their own.
Yeah.
I just saw that the other day, and I was like, what?
Roku.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them out there producing, which... For someone like me, it's sort of a good thing, because if you have one film that does kind of okay, you can get your foot in the door with a place like this, that, and they'll at least hear your pitch. So. Mm-hmm.
And even Disney's doing stuff, too. I mean, they're bringing horror into their platform now, where they, for the most part, was like, it's all family-friendly stuff.
They're doing that in Canada. They're not doing that here. Uh-huh. Here... And is too sacred. They're not willing to experiment that way.
That's why they bought Hulu.
Or like Star Wars is as tough as they get.
Ah, but see, that's why they bought Hulu in the U.S.
They bought Hulu, and a lot of the stuff that goes on Hulu here is going to Disney in Canada.
Yes.
So they're just sort of disseminating the product differently.
Yeah, if you ever get the opportunity, don't know if you're interested, but like I'm a big comic book guy, so things like The Son of Satan, Hellstrom, there's a TV show? It's awesome. It's as dark as you would expect something about the Son of Satan to be in.
I vaguely remember that coming and going, and yeah, that was on Hulu here.
Yes, and I saw it through something, and then it became available on Disney. It's like, yes, I can watch it again. But it was a good show. I enjoyed it much. I know of at least one director who was Canadian was involved in one of the episodes.
Is that our former Rue Morgue editor?
Chris? No. What the hell was her name? Damn it! See, I'm getting old. I'm forgetting names.
I mean, I forget.
Well, we're actually about the same age almost.
Yeah, I met her a few times. I liked her.
Yeah, she's a good person.
I don't remember if she directed one or wrote one, but she had some connection.
And for Hellstrom, she directed one. If we're talking about the same person.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I hate that I can refer to somebody's name. Okay. I'm going to move on. So, beyond werewolves, got zombies coming on. Are you going to explore any other kinds of monsters? Any dinosaurs? I saw you did a shark one.
Well, I produced Snow Shark, Ancient Snow Beast, which was one of the first of the goofy shark movies. And that was a young guy that I met through my festival who had done 200 short films. And he had done a short film about a snow shark. And when I saw he was doing a sequel to it, I was like, that's got to be a feature. So, I mean, I told him it had to be a feature, and I helped him raise a little bit of money and get some distribution for it. So that was like my... helping the young kid along and showing them how to get into the business, so to speak. But who knew? I think the only one before that had been Sharktopus, which Roger Corman produced.
We love Corman.
Who knew that there would be 500 of these things now?
Yes. And just even Corman's done, what, about 15 of them?
Oh, he's done so many.
Yeah.
And I can't take them. Like, one of my favorite things during the pandemic was to find indie shark movies that were about normal sharks in preposterous situations that were still scary. Like, there was one about a tidal wave that hit a foreign city.
Huh?
And these people were stuck in a grocery store, and it was flooded, and there was a school of sharks in there. It was an awesome movie, and it was scary. And so I like some scary shark movies. I don't like the goofy, silly ones.
So then you're not going to like the movie Virus Shark.
Which one?
virus shark.
Probably not.
Spider shark who gets COVID.
I see a lot of these things, and I can't even watch the trailers.
Yeah. No, this was my $182 one.
Such a cynical thing to be catering to that market. I just can't. I can't invest any of my life in that.
Gotcha. The lady's name was Jovanka Vukovic.
Jovanka, right.
Yeah. I should have remembered that name because it was an odd name.
Of the many hair colors.
Yes, she has the many hair colors. And a tattoo parlor.
Correct.
Yeah. But, so how do people invest in your current movie, The Frenzy
Movie? Our crowdfunding platform is Indiegogo, which, as you can imagine, is Indiegogo.com. The movie title is The Frenzy Moon. So if you go to Indiegogo.com and look up The Frenzy Moon, you will go right to our campaign page. We have what I think is a very cool pitch video that is worth watching and entertaining, regardless of whether or not you contribute. And what I'm looking to do is I'm actually trying to raise money for the whole film. I'm going to get that from investors. What I'm raising is money to put the special effects team to work over the summer because they need 3 full months to build all these creatures. And I need to get them started now, not later when I get the rest of the money.
Yeah, because you have to cascade these things, right?
Yeah.
So I saw the one picture you were using for promotional, and I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name. He did the covers for one of the two books, if I remember reading that properly.
Right. Fantasy artist named Patrick Riley, who I guess is sort of a Frazetta type, and he did the book covers for The Frenzy War and The Frenzy Wolves, which were books two and three of my trilogy. And I've had a lot of really good covers and movie posters, but the one he did for The Frenzy War, which is the one that you see most commonly in connection with this campaign, is my absolute favorite. And even though it was my publisher that hired him, not me, I did track him down and said that when I get the funds from this campaign, I want to hire him to do a new poster, you know, in that style, but for this movie. And that key art that he does will be used for many of the perks.
Awesome. Because that is a really awesome image.
Yeah, he's so talented.
It's got all the energy, it's got all the anger and all the ferocity of a bunch of werewolf people just jumping in on somebody.
The one thing I haven't been able to convey with any of the concept art I have is that the majority of the cast is female and there's a lot of strong women characters. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it a femme-centric movie, you know, like Ginger Snaps, where it's making a statement. But I just happen to have some very strong women, which is in vogue right now, for really good parts for some actresses.
So, I mean, did that color a lot of the story, having a direction that basically very specifically says, I want to have some strong female leads going into this and doing this way?
You know, it kind of worked with me as trying to defeat some tropes. Uh-huh. Like I did not want an African-American guy to be the first one killed. I wanted it to be a Caucasian guy to mm-hmm. be the first one killed. And everything that we now identify as a lot of stereotypes, I wanted to avoid. So that was how it started out. Now, since then, I've changed, you know, I gender swapped a couple of characters. A few other things have happened. And as it just turns out that I think the final roster that I settled on is very much in line with what Netflix and Hulu is showing these days on that level.
Cool. So it's not so much about trying to put forth an agenda or whatever. It's just a good story, right?
Correct. Yeah. And that's sort of the same thing that I did on Guns of Eden. The concept of Guns of Eden is it's like the first Rambo movie. It's like First Blood, only with a female character. And I made the point from the get-go, we're not going to have characters say through the whole film, but she's a woman! You know, we're just not going to address that. We're going to show it. We're not going to have people talking about it. And that's sort of something that I learned from William F. Nolan, the Logan's Run author.
Yep.
And he was pen pals with me when I was in high school, and I read all his interviews, and he was talking actually a lot about Zane Grey and some of the Western authors, and he stressed very much character through action. Like, what a character does says more about who they are than if you come right out and state what your theme is. So that's generally the approach I take. I wanted to make a really scary movie with some action that avoided some cliches, and people would appreciate that I didn't do those cliches. And if people want to read more into it, they can. But it's not the type of thing where, you know, the guys who blast Star Wars movies for all the wrong reason, that really toxic male fandom, they're not going to watch this trailer and say, oh my God, not another one of these fucking movies. So, no, it does not have an agenda.
Good. Cool. I mean, I like stuff, and I like it to be true to itself. I mean, regardless of whether it's that or this or the other thing over there, as long as it's real to itself. I mean, that's why I watch so many different things.
Now, what the actors bring to it, that's another thing. They may interpret it a different way and bring another side to it, and I like that. Yeah. I like people who surprise me on set and bring something, and generally, if they feel passionate about something and do something a different way than maybe I imagined it, it's going to make me look better in the long run.
Absolutely. Bring good talent, make good product.
So it is, in concept, it's my most ambitious film until the next one.
So more ambitious. Each movie is more ambitious each time? Generally?
Yes and no. I mean, I think Widow's Point was not necessarily an ambitious project because it was all set in the lighthouse. It was maybe, because it was self-contained, maybe it seemed like a small project that way. But working with Craig Sheffer, you know, my first time working with a real name in a lead role, that kind of made it bigger for a whole different reason.
Oh, good. That's good.
But I try to go into each one with a different purpose, a different goal, trying to do something different, and hopefully each time raising the bar a little bit more.
Growing as a creative influence and stuff, as it were.
Yeah, there's so little money in the indie world that you have to get some personal satisfaction out of it. You just have to.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's, I think, what's really should be the driving concept for anybody who's doing anything creative. If you don't enjoy doing it, why are you doing it?
Yeah. You know, and different people see different challenges when they do films. For a producer, the challenge might be getting a film done in 10 days instead of 15. It might be, how do we get this actor's scenes all done in 2 days, because that's all we can afford that name. I mean, there's all sorts of things that a producer will high-five his assistants for if they pull off that maybe aren't at all creative. It may be logistical.
Right.
But it's all towards the same purpose, which is making something as good as you can make it.
Like getting Vincent Price to be on Hilarious House of Frightenstein and recording all 109 bits or whatever in the pace of one weekend.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was my first exposure to Vincent Price. And
that show was awesome.
I remembered him because he was in every single friggin' episode.
Two times in every episode. There was an early bit and a later bit.
Really needed the money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that. I mean, that was a Hamilton. That's a local station that did that show. And it was like, that was one of the goofiest shows ever made, but it's awesome.
Well, I will give you a spoiler. You know, I am doing, I do a daily blog for the campaign, yep, which I call the Werewolf Hall of Fame. And I didn't limit it to a certain number, but each day I focus on a different letter. And the letter V does celebrate Billy Van.
Excellent. I had one. Oh, jam. One gentleman who was involved with the show on my show here.
Uh-huh.
I cannot remember for the life of me. Remember, it wasn't Billy Van. It was one of the gentlemen who actually helped produce and wrote some of the show.
Yep.
I hate getting old.
I'm sure that on that show, it was such a small crew that even the stagehand who got credit for changing light bulbs had his hand in all sorts of things.
Yeah. It was basically, even the actors were doing multiple roles, even though they were just saying, hey, we're just this guy. But no, actually, you're this guy, this guy, this guy, and this guy.
Well, I'm in Buffalo as we're having this conversation. This is where I've lived for 18 years now. I grew up, though, in Fredonia, an hour south of here. And I was in New York City for 21 years. But when I grew up in Fredonia, we got Buffalo stations, and we did get Canadian stations. So as a kid, I watched Hilarious House of Frankenstein all the time.
Oh, and there is a werewolf on that show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wolfman.
Wolfman.
I will be using his photo to promote this this podcast.
Excellent. Excellent. And
he's the guy who, unfortunately, his segments are the ones that are most butchered.
Yes.
You know, the ones that are legitimately available, they had to replace all those songs.
Yeah.
If you want to see the original songs, you got to get those bootlegs.
Yes. I'm trying. I still can't find his name. Damn it. Damn it. Ah, I'm not going to find it. Oh, well. But that brings us up to, after an hour of talking, brings us up to the end of the show. Is there anything else you would like to add last minute? How to find you, sort of stalk you kind of things without the actual real stalking side?
Let's see. Give me money for my movie. Give me money for my movie. Give me money for my movie. And give me money for what? No, I think that covers it.
Okay, cool. I'm personally recommending the project to a couple of my friends, and I know at least one of them will fund. I'm going to be doing something at some point or whatever, because I like the idea. I like werewolves.
Much appreciated.
It's all good, man. It's all about the house supporting and everything, right?
Yep. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on and being on
the face in the book, as usual.
And the Insta and the tweeters and whatever the hell else is out there. So everybody, thank you all for joining
us. On my Instagram. That's not really me. I don't know how to log on to Instagram, so the family takes care of that.
You have a paid intern.
Sort of.
Yeah, like some of the other famous people on Insta and Twitter and whatever else. They have a paid intern doing the posts.
Paid with house and board.
Exactly. So thanks again for coming on. Everybody else in the chat room and the streams and whatever else is listening, you have yourselves an amazing after rotten good time. Be well, be happy, be all of that other stuff that works for you, and have fun.
Be independent.
That too.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their picnic.